This is On Target St. John's, a look at politics, crime, education. What's happening here with the people who know? The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station. Now, your On Target St. John's host, Linda Swain.
And good afternoon, everyone. And I want to start the show this afternoon by sending this message out to a woman I got off the phone with not too long ago, and she was looking for some answers in regards to the COVID vaccine. And she was calling on behalf of her mother, 70 and plus, I should say. And she was expressing some frustration because her mother had registered by phone some time ago, had not received her call back. And her daughter was, of course, expressing some frustration. How do we know that she's actually registered? How can she get her vaccine? It seems strange to me. We haven't got a call yet. These kinds of things. And I had literally no answers for her. No answers. And we hung up, and I turned around. And as I turned around and looked at our emails coming in, boom, here comes the email from Eastern Health. COVID vaccine clinics open to all residents now, ages 70 and over, whether you're registered or not, and whether or not you've registered or and got a call back or not. So if for that woman that called me literally moments before this information came in, I want you to listen carefully. All the details are on VOCM.com, what to do, how to do it, and you can register your mom. And this is the same is true for everybody in the Eastern Health region who has a mom or a dad or is a mom and a dad themselves, if you know what I'm saying, is 70 and over, and they want their vaccination. So all the information is up on VOCM.com, and we literally just got that in. The phones have not been stopping in the VOCM newsroom. Lots of people with very serious concerns and questions about COVID-19. And of course, we were half expecting the possibility of a COVID briefing today. That's not happening. They're just going to be sending out a release. So hopefully that means good news, especially as the situation evolves on the West Coast. Be that as it may. Government is getting back down to business after the longest election campaign in Newfoundland and Labrador history. All but one of the recently elected MHAs were sworn in this morning. And later this afternoon, the first order of business will be to elect a new Speaker of the House of Assembly. Premier Fury has already indicated that he intends to get down to business as quickly as possible. But there are a long list of pressing needs and concerns that have been simmering for an extended period with little or no action under a caretaker government. Among them is the plight faced by trades workers, many of whom have taken a serious hit with the downturn in the oil and gas industry. Well, here to discuss the situation facing trades workers is the executive director of Trades NL, Darren King. Hello.
Hi, Linda. How are you doing today?
Oh, great. More rain, drizzle and fog. I will get through it, I suppose.
Yeah, wow, the weather has been wild the last week or so. But yeah, it's one of the things that we deal with living in Newfoundland and Labrador. Still a great place to be.
It is indeed. So what is the current situation facing trades workers here in Newfoundland and Labrador?
Well, we're coming off a pretty challenging couple of years, to be honest with you. When COVID started last year, just shy of 1,000 workers in Muskrat Falls. That's significantly reduced now, of course, because the project, while back on track for work purposes, is actually in the wind-down phases. Probably the biggest hit we took was the shutdown of the Husky project in Argentia, where I think we peaked out somewhere in the area of 2,500 or so workers out there, and today we've got, I think, a dozen or so. So it's sort of been a big decline and not a lot of comeback over the last 18 to 20 months for us. We're seeing a few things pick up a little bit now, but generally membership for us, we're around the 75% unemployed mark, and that's pretty concerning with, at this point at least, not a lot on the horizon to look forward to.
You mentioned Husky being the biggest hit. What is the current situation of Husky? You say just a handful of people there now, but what will be happening, if anything?
Well, we have, as I said, about a dozen or so people out there now. We're basically just in care maintenance mode, keeping the streets clear and making sure that nothing happens out there. We really don't know. I do have a meeting with Husky next week. We've had some preliminary talks with the local project team here, and excuse me, there's some hope that there may be some small scopes of work to get restarted out there this year. I really don't know what that means. We don't have any numbers around that. From what I've been hearing, you're probably talking maybe 30 or 40 people, perhaps a little bit more. But I have a meeting next week where I'm hoping I might get some more insight into the long-term picture. You know, it's hard to believe that they won't proceed with the project. The top sides to that project are actually just about complete down in Ingleside, Texas. So it's hard to imagine that they'd finish the top sides and not do the GBS that we're working on. So, you know, we're cautiously optimistic that at some point in the near future, we're going to start to see that ramp back up. It may be closer to 22, but who knows?
Are you more hopeful now that oil prices seem to be rising?
Yeah, I certainly am very hopeful. I mean, that's always a good sign, of course, because when the prices go up, companies are making money, and that's, of course, that's what it's all about. So, you know, that certainly gives us some pause for optimism on the Husky project. Not so much, you know, for the Bay du Nord and the Terra Nova. We really don't know what's happening with either of those yet. But certainly with Husky, yeah, we're, you know, cautiously optimistic. There's, as I said, you know, if that one goes, there's a lot of jobs to go back out there for maybe another year, year and a half. And that's something that everybody is really looking forward to if we can get there.
How much lead time would be necessary to ramp things back up again?
From our perspective, very little. I'm certain a contractor might have a different perspective because they've got different things they'd have to do. But if, you know, if I got a call today that said, you know, we're going to ramp back up in a week or so, I suspect we could have most of our people ready to get their, make sure their certifications are in order and all that sort of stuff, through alcohol and drug testing done and whatnot. So, you know, within 5 to 7 days, we probably could get mobilized pretty quickly.
And you say there's not a lot of work needs to be done to complete the topsides there.
No, we're familiar with the topsides because that's, you know, that continues to be a bone of contention for us. That's a significant piece of work on developing a resource for Newfoundlanders and Labradorians that's being done in Texas. And, you know, we've always held the position and we maintain that could easily have been done here in Bull Arm or pieces of it in Bull Arm and perhaps Marystown on the West Coast as has been done in the past. So for that reason, you know, we've always maintained sort of a close monitoring what's happening there. And to my knowledge now, they're probably close to 90% complete. They had a very short shutdown during COVID and then they went back to work and work continued on it. As did Marystown, by the way. Marystown is doing a small piece of work for the topsides and their work continued. So all of that gives us optimism that the piece that we're going to do in Argentia will continue.
So you'd like to see that work completed sooner rather than later. But even so, that's, by the sounds of it, it's not a there's not a lot of scope left in that project. So what happens then?
Well, that's a good question. You know, there's lots of opportunities on the horizon. When we put out our press release a couple of days ago to the Premier, to the media, regarding the Premier and government, we offered our congratulations. But we're really looking to re-engage with the Premier now around our NL benefits position that we've been advocating for, because, you know, we've been losing lots of jobs here in the province. And the position that we've taken and we will continue to take with government is that, you know, we're in tough times, no question about it, between COVID and the financial situation facing the province. And, you know, if there's one quick thing you can do with zero cost is simply bring in a policy of local hiring priority. We worked through COVID last year and we watched many, many workers, and you don't need to take my word for it. You can invite callers at some point in time to reach out to you. Many workers on the Cornerbrook Hospital, on the long-term care facilities in Gander and Grand Falls, just to name those three. Many workers come in through COVID. They were exempt from the 14-day isolation period, and they went to work while we had literally, in some cases, thousands of workers within a 20-mile radius sitting at home, unemployed. So, you know, our advice to government is why not adopt a local hiring policy on public infrastructure, just the same policy that you have on resource development projects. When we go to work at Husky, when we go to work in Muskrat, there's a local hiring policy which basically says that if you are qualified, you must be from Newfoundland and Labrador to get hired first. And if there's no qualified Newfoundlanders and Labradorians, you can go outside the province. But the number of contractors have been less than supportive of the local workforce, shall we say. They brought workers in from a number of different provinces when there was really no need for it. So, you know, we're going to continue to advocate that that policy be brought in. There's a number of potential infrastructure projects on the horizon that that could apply to. The Waterford replacement is still only in its infancy. There's a new prison that's being talked about, as you'll be aware of. There's a federal project that's been talked about and committed to by the Prime Minister with the tunnel across the straits from Newfoundland to the island to Labrador. So in any of those projects, if this kind of policy were to be adopted, it would at least assure us that the maximum possible opportunities for work would go to Newfoundlanders and Labradorians first. And in our view, that would be a great start to getting people back to work here.
My guest today on Target is the Executive Director of Trades NL, Darren King. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain, On Target St. John's on VOCM.
My guest today on Target is the Executive Director of Trades NL, Darren King. And Darren, you've been talking a little bit about the NL Trades Agreement, something that Trades NL has been calling for quite some time now. What's holding things up in that regard?
We've actually advanced the discussions a fair amount in the fall before Christmas. The Premier assigned the file to Minister Byrne, and we've been in MEP with Minister Byrne, and we've been back and forth exchanging information. So it actually moved considerably in a short period of time there, more than it had in the last couple of years. So we're certainly happy with that. The Premier himself has been engaged in the discussions on the file with me on many, many occasions, and in the recent election, during their campaign, they made some commitments to us, as did other parties, of course, but they made some commitments around pursuing NL benefits and including trades NL in the discussion. So right now, we've written a letter to the Premier just seeking a meeting, recognizing he's extremely busy and there's a lot happening. I don't anticipate that will happen real quickly, but hopefully in the not-too-distant future. And we're hoping that we're basically going to be able to get the discussions back on track and get the file moving. As I've said many times, it's difficult to understand. There's a no cost associated with what we're asking for. It's simply asking to give local hiring priority and to give priority to apprentices, which is a key piece that often gets missed, Linda. Part of what we're advocating here is that there will be spots on public infrastructure projects for the hiring of apprentices, which are our new tradesmen and women. If they're not able to get jobs, and oftentimes they can't break in because unless there's a priority, most contractors will go for senior experienced tradesmen and women. So we're asking for spots to be put aside for apprentices that give them their work experience, which allows them to go back to school and do their block training and to achieve their Red Seal status. It's a win-win solution as far as we can see down the road. We are going to lose some of our senior trade workers. We do have an aging workforce, and if we're going to maintain the skill set that we have in the province today, we have to be further sighted into the future, looking further into the future, I should say, and realize that we're only going to get there if we provide training for apprentices. And, you know, it's our position that government has a responsibility to play in that. They run the apprenticeship office. When they build infrastructure, they ought to provide places for apprentices to get their training and experience. So hopefully, I guess that's a long answer, I realize, but hopefully we'll get those discussions moving fairly quickly, and hopefully we'll see something of a receptive attitude from government to make this happen and put this issue to bed, so at least then people can feel comfortable that whatever government work comes out, if we have qualified people here, then they're going to get the first jobs.
You mentioned the unemployment rate among skilled trades workers in Newfoundland and Labrador. What kind of a contribution do skilled trades make to the provincial economy as a whole?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's a lot you could pack into that answer for sure, but I guess two things come to mind to me. First of all, we have in our organization, we've got about 75% unemployed. Those numbers fluctuate literally on a daily basis, but for argument purposes, we'll use the number 75 today. So that's 75% of 18,000. You can do the math very quickly and find out how many people that means. In construction, the normal spin-off jobs are anywhere from 5 to 7 to 1, depending on which research institute you talk to. What that means is if you create a construction job, there's going to be between five and seven new jobs created to provide the supports and services for that construction job. So if you take the 2,000 that were so we had out with Husky, multiplied by five, that's 10,000 other jobs that were affected by that downturn. So that's a pretty significant impact on the economy, you know, and sometimes people just don't understand that. It's not only about the skilled trades workers, it's all of those spin-off jobs that are created and all of those local companies, you know, here in Donovan's Industrial Park and throughout the city and throughout the province, who supply the services and materials that are required on these jobs. So there's a huge impact there. The other impact that often gets overlooked is in our organization in particular over the last 5 years or so, our trades workers collectively have invested about $25 million to support local charities, to refurbish emergency rooms at the Healthcare Health Science Center, to buy new imaging equipment for the Health Science Center. We've done work in the Janeway. We put money into Daffodil House, Ronald McDonald House, Easter Seals, and the list just goes on and on. So, you know, there's a huge impact, both direct and indirect, when the construction sector is not active, for sure.
You mentioned that thousands of workers sitting on their hands with some of these major projects that are underway now because the contractors involved there are, as you put it, less than supportive of the local workforce. Why is it? Why are some of these contractors so reluctant to hire local workers?
That's a good question, and I don't know that I'm really in a position to give you a good answer to it because we struggle with it a little bit. I suspect that some contractors get a comfort level with a group of workers that they have and oftentimes move from project to project, and they just bring the workforce with them wherever they go. As an example, I think the West Coast Hospital, about a year and a half or more ago, there was a public display, actually, of some of our union members because there was an iron worker company coming out of PEI, I believe, and they brought pretty much 95% of their entire crew with them to do the work. So I can only assume that is a combination of they have a crew and they want to keep their crew, or they feel they can get work cheaper and therefore pay less labor and make more money. I don't know what else it might be. Because it certainly cannot be about the quality of the work here. There's no question about that. I mean, the feedback that we get from all across Canada is that if people had a choice any day of the week, they'd take skilled trades workers from Newfoundland and Labrador before any other province because of the work ethic and the quality of the work that gets done.
So is it purely a union versus non-union type of scenario?
Not entirely. Although no doubt that could be a factor into it for sure, but not entirely because, you know, in our policy, we're not advocating that it has to be union work. You know, we're hopeful and optimistic that if the policy gets adopted, that we will be able to get the work because we've got the bulk of skilled trades workers here in the province who are the most qualified and who are getting the best training on a regular basis. But, I mean, there are lots of non-union skilled trades workers in the province as well who still don't get jobs. So it's not entirely a union versus non-union thing, I don't think.
My guest today on Target is the Executive Director of TradesNL, Darren King. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
My guest today on Target is the Executive Director of TradesNL, Darren King. And we've been talking a lot, Darren, you and I, about the Trades Benefits Agreement. But if I recall, then Minister Jerry Byrne previously indicated that some kind of a balance needs to be struck because so many Newfoundlanders and Labradorians benefit from, and the province as a whole benefits from, workers who work on job sites outside of this province. We have so many rotational workers that are going back and forth and moving back and forth and benefiting this province in so many ways. Is there a danger that if Newfoundland and Labrador were to implement an NL First Benefits Trades Agreement that other provinces might follow suit or just say, hey, where you're no longer welcome?
Short answer is no, in my opinion. And I say that based on history, that we currently have, through a different name, we have an NL benefits agreement in place for Argentia, for Husky. We have one in place at Muskrat Falls, and we have one in place for Hebron and Hibernia and other resource development projects in the province. They weren't called NL benefits agreements. They were just called resource development benefits agreements. But they all had what we're asking for. They had local hiring preference. hiring of women and Indigenous groups and other underrepresented groups, all included in their projects, and there was never ever any negativity come out of that for Newfoundlanders and Labradorians working outside the province. So the first thing that I would say to that is that there's absolutely zero evidence to support that claim. The second point that I would make is the bulk of the workers from Newfoundland and Labrador who work outside the province are going to jobs because the jobs can't be filled by locals in other provinces. And I can give you two examples right now if you want. We just heard from contractors out of doing work, in Ottawa and Ontario, one in Ottawa and I think one is just outside, looking for three or four different groups of trades workers. There could be 300 or 400 jobs up there. And they're coming here because they can't fill the positions. So there's no answer. There's no evidence, no evidence to support that claim, in my view. I've heard that, and I've heard it repeatedly from officials, not the minister in particular, but officials. And I've asked them to show me where it's happened in the past. And no one can show us any evidence to suggest that there's any validity to that. We've done benefits agreements. We're doing them as we speak. We're referring workers to Muskrat. They come in looking for carpenters or iron workers or pipe fitters. We send in local workers. If we can't fill the jobs in Newfoundland and Labrador, then there's a process where we can bring people in. And there's never been any pushback on that whatsoever. So from our perspective, unless somebody has evidence to the contrary, that's just not a valid claim.
I know these things always happen in cycles or waves, but skilled trades workers have generally always been highly sought after. And they're usually very mobile. They'll go wherever the work is. And Newfoundlanders and Labradorians have been famous for that over the centuries. Are we losing skilled trades workers because of some of these difficulties in getting securing local jobs?
I haven't seen a big trend in that yet. Although I suspect we are. I mean, I know of some personally for sure, but I suspect that we are going to lose some over time. I think that's inevitable in the climate that we're in today. Unless we can get some of the projects back working, and unless we can get some of the work that's going out of the province back here, because that's sort of the other piece. A little while ago, we talked a bit about workers from outside the province coming in here and taking jobs that exist here. The piece we haven't talked about is that there's a lot of work that could be done in the province that's leaving the province. And I mentioned the top sides for the Husky project in Texas. As you probably would be aware, before the shutdown, there was plans for a big piece of work for the Come By Chance oil refinery, the Coker project, to be done in China. There were significant plans for the Terra Nova FPSO to do a full refit in Spain, most of the work which could be done here and still can be done here. And with the recent announcement a year and a half or so ago on the Bay du Nord project, every evidence that we have there suggests that the bulk of that work is going to be done in Asia. So it's not just about securing the jobs that exist in the province, like public infrastructure. It's about keeping work in the province that can be done in the province and that's meant to support projects in the province. So there's a dual track there. And unless and until we get to the point where we truly maximize those opportunities, you're going to see a downsizing of the skilled trades for sure. You're going to see some older trades workers retire, but it's going to make it more difficult to attract new people into the profession if they don't see an opportunity, first of all, to get a job. Secondly, as an apprentice, they see an opportunity to get their training completed and to be able to stay here and support their families. No one is going to choose to do a career where there's no opportunity for employment.
What about the capacity to competitively bid on local contracts? How are we doing in that regard?
We certainly have the capacity to bid. There's no question about it. If you're asking from the trades perspective, we have lots of capacity. As I said, we've got just about 18,000 members from 16 trade unions. So, we have lots of capacity to bid work and do work here. There's little that I'm aware of that couldn't be done here other than the Terra Nova FPSO. My understanding, it has to come out of the water at some point in time for underwater work or for work on the hull that's below the waterline. So that'll happen in Spain. But the rest of what needs to be done with that vessel could easily be done here. From a local contractor perspective, we've got world-class contractors here in this province. Pennycon is one that comes to mind simply because Pennycon is doing a project with us in Argentia. But we've got all kinds of others like Pennycon, and we've got Technica firms here and subsea firms here. Like, in my view, there's very little reason why there's not capacity both in the workforce and with the contractors here in this province to bid work and to do work here.
And why is it traditionally then that we've not always gotten those opportunities?
I think there's probably a number of reasons for that. In lots of instances, I think you can trace it back to political announcements. Big companies tend to do a really good job of advocating to governments. And, you know, in some cases, my experience is, at least to speak as I find, in some cases, they'll attempt to, if I could use the term loosely, brainwash people. I mean, there's a lot of falsehoods that get said by big companies in trying to move work out of province. You know, ultimately, their goal is to do the work for as cheap as possible to make a profit for their companies and their boards of directors and their shareholders. No question about that. And that's fair game. I mean, I understand that, and I would expect no less of the company. The issue, though, I think, is that our governments have to stand up and be equally as strong in defending the rights of the people of the province to make sure we get maximum benefits. And there, you know, there's instances in the past where that has happened, and it covers all political stripes. It's not a partisan statement whatsoever. And there's other instances in the past where governments have not, and they've made deals that have been less than generous or supportive for the people of the province. And I think that's really where it has to start when you're talking about government work and resource development projects. If there's a will to do things, then you'll find a way to do it. And I think that's where it starts. We just got to have strong leadership and knowledgeable people involved in the negotiating process, and make sure that the companies understand if you're going to come here and do work, you're going to come and you're going to do it for the benefit of the province, not just for your shareholders.
So is it about providing, from a government standpoint, I mean, providing the right incentives or imposing the right kind of penalties, if you will?
Well, I think there's probably a combination, actually, of both. But certainly, you know, certainly incentives, I mean, around the royalty regime that's negotiated. And I, you know, I understand fully that we wouldn't expect any government to negotiate away royalties totally just for the sake of short-term jobs. That's not what I'm advocating for. I think you have to find a balance there. But we do need the jobs as well, because it's the jobs that will allow us to keep a world-class skilled trade workforce, and it's also the local jobs that will allow us to develop a good onshore industry to supplement the offshore oil industry. And I'm not talking about the construction side now. I'm talking about the operations, because the industry is heading into a very technological age, and there's going to be a lot of operations that are going to need to be completed onshore, and that's a piece of work that can also be done here in the province. So I think it comes down to a compromise between royalties and jobs created and investment in the province. So the province obviously is going to have to make some sacrifices, but I guess my message is I don't think the province should be the only one sacrificing. I think the companies have to realize as well that if they're coming into Newfoundland and Labrador to process our resources, then there's got to be a fair return for the province, including the development of the resource here, which creates construction jobs for the long term.
I know we've talked a lot about it in the past, and there's been some real pushes and movement towards addressing the aging workforce, particularly in the skilled trades, and attracting more young people to the industry. How are we doing in that regard as far as our post-secondary institutions go?
Well, we have good training facilities here within our own building trade unions. You know, we actually have seven or eight of our own unions that do their own local training and do a lot of training. So I think we're on par with anybody there for sure. Likewise, the private colleges and the College of the North Atlantic here are good schools and do great training. The pre-apprentice training is not the issue, I don't think. I mean, our courses are strong and the curriculum is evolving, and all of the training schools, particularly I can speak for the building trades training schools because I know them and I deal with them more directly, that they're evolving on a daily basis. As new expectations arise for the trades worker, they're modifying their curriculum to make sure that the workers that go through their program are the best possible trained that they can be at that point in time. But the training is only a piece of the issue. The second piece goes back to what we talked about earlier, is that once you pump these apprentices out the door with their training, they have to get an opportunity to go to work. And it's that first opportunity that's critical, because it gets them work experience, which allows them in turn to go back and do their what we call block training. So they work for a period of time, they go back to school for a period of time. And that happens over the course of a number of years until they get to what we call a journey person or Red Seal status, which means essentially they can take their trade anywhere across Canada because of an interprovincial agreement we have. So they're never going to get there unless there's job opportunities. So it's a catch-22. Having the good training is only part of the equation. We got to find the opportunities to let these people go to work immediately and to hone their skills.
So are we doing any better in that regard as far as hiring some of those apprentices?
We're doing good on our resource development projects. Again, like I mentioned, the Muskrat Falls project and Huskies West White Rose. We do good there because there's a benefit agreement in place that requires a certain percentage of apprentices for every journey person that's there on site. We have to follow that. That's part of the law. So we do follow that. And so we're guaranteed to get apprentices working in those projects. The issue, back to the NL benefits, is that there is no such guarantee on provincial work. And I can give you countless examples where work over here at the Moncore Science Building, for example. I mean, there was very few, if any, apprentices on that site. And at one point, we talked to officials within, I think it was Transportation and Works at the time, and they couldn't tell us. We asked them directly, how many apprentices do you have? Well, we don't know, because we don't monitor it and we don't have a requirement for it. So therein lies the problem. But on the resource development projects, we do have that requirement. Similar, Linda, if I might say, a little shy, different topic, but similar applies to females in the trades. Like we were leading the country at one point, maybe 3 years ago, with about 14 to 15% of the workforce in Newfoundland being female trades workers. And that was back in the day, of course, when we had projects going, the Hebron project, we had the Valet project in Argentia, and we had Muskrat Falls. And, you know, at one point, I mean, we had 16 or 17,000 people working. Those three projects all had benefits agreements which required the hiring, not only of apprentices, but of females. And so we, because of that, we achieved 14-15%. Since those projects have started winding down, we, right now, we're probably around 8% at best. And that's primarily because there's only two, Muskrat Falls, I should say, really, is the only big resource project that's happening now, along with the Voisey Bay expansion. And the provincial work, there's a fair amount of provincial work happening, but there is no requirement for a percentage of women that's being enforced. And therefore, our percentages are dropping because, as I said before, a lot of contractors tend to gravitate towards the seasoned, experienced trades workers. And they don't always be women or underrepresented groups. So it's a challenge. Unless we bring in some policy that supports local hiring and supports local training and the hiring of local underrepresented groups, we're always going to struggle, I think, to bring new workers into the trades.
So the onus is on government on that, or with contractors?
Well, it works both ways. Contractors have an opportunity if they're working union or non-union. I mean, they have an opportunity to say, to set a target and say, we want X number percent of females or Indigenous on this project. But I mean, government can really just set the law. It's very simple. Government just makes a policy that if you bid public infrastructure work, you must have a policy, you must hire locally. And the language is already developed because we use it on the resource projects. So they could say that. Secondly, they can say that, you know, one in three or one in four or one in two must be apprentices. They can set a percentage of target for women and underrepresented groups on the project. And, you know, again, in our view, as we've suggested, all they need to do is have a non-compliance penalty. If you get a project here and you don't meet the criteria, then there's a first-time offense penalty. And if there's a repeat offense, then you get you could, for example, get barred from bidding any government work for a period of time. My view is if you brought in a penalty like that, it would only happen once. And the first time it happened and somebody got penalized for it, all the rest of the contractors would fall in line very quickly. So, I'm not putting it almost totally on government, because contractors do have flexibility to hire. But I think government can set a policy that requires it, and it makes it easier for everybody to live with.
My guest today on Target is the Executive Director of Trades NL, Darren King. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
And we're talking to Darren King. He's the Executive Director of Trades NL. And Darren, the interim green report was delayed. It's due soon. Were you part of those discussions or did you hope to be?
No, we weren't at all, actually. And hadn't really given a lot of thought to it because it really didn't appear, at least, that any of their deliberations would have any direct bearing on us. I mean, other than, I suppose, if they were to recommend less work in the province or something like that. But I'm not sure that's kind of the road they're going down. It seemed to me that they were looking more at systemic kinds of changes. And I guess they felt it had no direct bearing on us. They didn't reach out to us. And likewise, we didn't talk to them. So I don't know. We'll see. We'll see where the report goes. If there's anything in there at all that affects trades workers, then we'll certainly be engaging for sure.
We're in a bit of a tough situation here in Newfoundland and Labrador, and in fact around the world with COVID and the rest of it. We're looking at ways to help build up the economy. What kind of a role does government play in economic stimulus when it comes to the skilled trades?
Well, we're hoping that we'll see some stimulus projects come, you know, combination of between the province and the federal government. The history of construction work and stimulus projects is just fantastic on the economy. As I mentioned to you before, you know, for every job created, there's, you know, four or five or six or so spin-off jobs created to support the construction activity. So there's no better economic generator out there than that. And there are a number of projects in the hopper here. The new federal prison, of course, is one that the provincial government's been pursuing for some time here, or provincial prison, I should say. We also saw a commitment from the Prime Minister to explore the tunnel project from the island to Labrador. And, you know, who knows? There's some talk of the clean green energy project, Gull Island, sometime down the road. So I think there's definitely a role for government to try and facilitate moving forward with some of these. I think, you know, people recognize the tough time we're in, though, and that they're going to have to make some tough financial choices. There's no question about that. But from our perspective, we're hopeful that they'll bring some projects forward. We want to partner with government and partner with our contractors. We believe that there's some small things you can do here, like the NL benefits, that can have a big impact and at no cost to government. And it can be a win for everybody in the province. So, you know, we're certainly hopeful that they move in that direction. But, you know, as you say, with the Green Report coming and the environment we're in, it's not an easy situation for government, and government can't solve the problems alone. I think most people realize that. But hopefully the things that government can do are the things that government will do to try and stimulate the economy and support local business and support local workers.
Does Ottawa have a role to play here?
Yeah, I think absolutely Ottawa does. You know, there's a bit of irony in that in the construction industry, in that the meetings that I do weekly with my counterparts, and many of those involve the Minister of Infrastructure federally. Most of the other provinces are seeing a sort of a boom in construction. They're between, I guess, the feds and the province, the local province, they're doing construction activity, and there's lots of opportunities for trades workers. So we're kind of the exception. Our numbers are probably the opposite of what most provinces are. So I think there's definitely a role. There's no question. I mean, the three projects that I just mentioned, the federal government can come to the table and step up, either with some direct financing to the province or, you know, as a partner with the province and maybe with others, for sure. But, you know, the feds are in a position, much better position than the province, I think, to step up on some of these projects and play a lead role and help stimulate the economy here. And in the long run, not only does it put people to work, but it'll get us out of the tough spot that we're in right now financially.
Is it government's role, though, to stimulate the economy? And is it even feasible given our current fiscal situation?
Well, I think government's role is ever changing. You know, I mean, having been there for a long time myself, you know, I think government's role really is to step in whenever there's a need for some support for society, whether that's social support or economic support. Governments can't wash their hands of their duty to run the province and to support the people of the province. So I think, yeah, definitely there's a role. How much of a role they can play financially in projects in these times, I don't know. I mean, that's a really good question. But You know, I guess they've got to make some tough choices around what projects are necessary, what can we move forward with, and where can we get support. And as I said, I think my view would be on the projects we've talked about, particularly the prison and the tunnel, there's a significant responsibility on the federal government to be party to that. Obviously, the Her Majesty's Penitentiary holds federal prisoners, so the federal government has a strong vested interest in that, and they're the ones that have been advocating for the tunnel. So, you know, I think the province can try and take some steps to push the feds in the direction of those two projects alone will create a significant local employment in the short term.
So you've reached out to the Premier. Any hopes of meeting with him anytime soon or any of the other appropriate ministers?
Well, we've actually written today. We wrote all of the MHAs to just offer congratulations, and we're hopeful that you know, in the coming weeks we'll get an opportunity to meet with some of the relevant ministers for infrastructure and labor and skills, as well as the Premier. You know, I'm not in a big rush. I mean, to be fair, the Premier has been very accessible to us and to me. And I'm pretty certain that if I were to reach out today, I would probably have a conversation with them before the end of today if it was something extremely important. This, you know, this, while this is important, is not of an urgent nature. So, you know, I'm guessing over the next week or two, we may get a response and get an opportunity to go in and chat. And, you know, as I said, our interest is partnering and working together. I mean, it is a tough spot we're in, but in order to take the province out of this tough spot, we got to find a way to create some jobs and put some money back in the economy. And I believe that there's a role for Trade Janelle and for our workforce to play in doing that. So we'll work with government and other partners, whoever's going to be at the table, to try and move forward in a reasonable way, but in a realistic way that serves both the interests of the province and the interests of the local workforce.
We just have a little over a minute to go, and I would normally ask you to wrap up, but I think you sort of have there. But do you think that your role formerly in government helps you navigate some of that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I served in a lot of portfolios, as you know, and moved around a fair bit and got to understand government very well and how it works. And I think that's that experience is very helpful because while I'm advocating as strongly as I can for our organization, I do know the challenges that government faces, and I'm trying to position us in a way that that the outcome is going to be beneficial to us, but also beneficial to government. I understand where they are and understand where they need to be. But I also have a great better understanding than I did perhaps now of the workforce and the external factors that influence government. So, yeah, I think that the experience is definitely valuable and definitely assists us in trying to move our objectives forward for sure.
Darren King, thank you.
Linda, it's a great opportunity as always. I really appreciate the time and the time to connect and talk about issues important to our industry.
And we'll be back tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Do join us then. Thanks for listening.